Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to George Eaton and Lucy Fishen about the fallout from the reshuffle and how Labour might respond. Then Ian Steadman and Juliet Jakes and I talk football. Was this the best World Cup ever? We'll find out later. Joined by George Eaton and Lucy Fisher to talk about the fallout from the reshuffle and what Labour's response to it should be. So, George, first of all, were Labour put on the back foot by this reshuffle? Were they expecting it to be as big as it was, and has their response been commensurately large?
I don't think anyone was really expecting it to be as big as it was. Certainly, very few saw the Gove move coming. William Hague was clearly increasingly detached and had lost his passion. But I don't think anyone expected him to stand down as Foreign Secretary before the election. I think what it has done is it's shown that David Cameron can still surprise us, that he can still take the initiative. It was an impressive display of prime ministerial authority at a time when, in an age when it's increasingly hard for political leaders to control the news agenda. So I think it's been a success in that respect, and has shown also that the Conservatives are relentlessly focused on winning the election now. The reshuffle was all about putting campaigning before governing. And I think there are some Labour MPs, especially those fighting to win marginal seats, who will worry about the fact that the Conservatives under Linton Crosby have become a more disciplined team. They're less divided than they were before, and also have huge funding at their disposal.
And do you agree with that, Lucy? Do you think this is a kind of, this is Crosby's reshuffle?
I think that's right. And I think we can see that most clearly in the fact that so many Eurosceptics have joined the cabinet. Clearly, Cameron doesn't want the party to keep banging on about Europe. But clearly, he's had to give in to that now because that's the flavour.
One of the things I'm most interested about, George, in this reshuffle is the kind of ideological momentum of the Tory party. So he wrote about this in your politics column and in The Leader, this idea that, you know, the rising stars of the right are very ideologically driven. There aren't a lot of pragmatic Cameroons who you hear talked about a lot. Where in Labour is the kind of ideological momentum at the moment?
I think in Labour it is Miliband himself who has the clearest sort of vision of what he wants to do. The division is over how that translates into policy and then what kind of campaign that translates into. But it's true that the Labour appears a much less sort of diverse political animal than the Conservative Party, where you do have multiple factions. Sometimes it feels as if there's a new Conservative group launching all the time. There are some in Labour who feel that their party does lack intellectual vitality. I think that in some ways, though, that's simply because the left has united around a sort of consensus that New Labour got quite a lot of things wrong, but also that there's no point in trying to resurrect the policies of the 1980s. And so that's why there is this centre-left consensus in Labour with few nuances here or there over how radical you be or how cautious you should be. But that is, I think that is something that, you know, Miliband can take comfort from, because you know, Labour is just not ideologically divided in the way it was in the past.
And Lucy, do you agree with that as well?
I do agree with George, but I think we also have to remember that we're looking at this from inside the Westminster village. In fact, I think that while Labour do have more intellectual cohesion, in fact, their messaging is poor compared to the Tories because of Linton, who's telling them all just keep repeating long-term economic plan. Whereas I think the voters don't really understand this intellectual stance that Labour are trying to stand for.
And George, where does this all leave the Lib Dems as the two parties pursue more aggressive differentiation from each other?
I think for the Lib Dems, I mean, Clegg has said they don't want to be a split the difference party. And so he has started talking about what they would do after 2015. Now, not even the most optimistic Lib Dem thinks, you know, they'll have any chance of being a majority party, of course. You know, they'll be lucky to keep more than half their seats. But it's about distinguishing the party, not simply saying we'll be sort of nicer than the Tories and more economically responsible than Labour, but this is what we believe in. And so he's made some big speeches on the economy and education recently for that. But you see with the bedroom tax shift they've made, they are in danger of being a split the difference party again. So on the one hand, they're moving away from defending the policy as it stands and saying we would reform it so disabled adults are exempt. And so only those who are offered suitable smaller homes are forced to pay the charge. But on the other hand, they're not calling for it to be scrapped, which is the Labour position. And Labour, Rachel Reeves has already said, Labour will look to table another motion when Parliament returns after the recess calling for its abolition. And of course, the Lib Dems won't be able to vote for it. The other thing they've said, and Lib Dem strategists have said to me recently, is they're very keen to talk up their record in government, which they don't feel is sufficiently known. So that will be their mission in the summer. They think
they don't get any credit for the income tax brackets, for example.
So they want to get more credit for that. They want to talk up the work Steve Webb has done at pensions, the pupil premium, the work they've done on apprenticeships and skills. They hope they will get some credit for that from the voters, because looking at their poll ratings, there are some Lib Dems who expected them to be in a better position than they are now. And they are worried that they don't seem to have been boosted by the economic recovery.
That's going to be very difficult for them, because they have very few natural friends in the press. I mean, there'll be a lot of people who'd be rushing to give the Tories credit for the economic recovery, less so for the Dems. Finally, George, Milton Keynes, the glamorous surrounds Milton Keynes, the Labour's National Policy Forum. Are we expecting any big surprises out of that this weekend?
Well, Labour will hope for no big surprises. They are currently furiously negotiating with delegates, trying to reach a consensus on some of the big policy areas that are outstanding, such as rail, such as social care, such as Trident. Not all of the... I think the idea is to try and reach consensus in sessions and agreement, not to have votes. Obviously, the nightmare scenario for Miliband is that you do have minority positions that are passed and that will then go to conference and that will cause trouble for him. The hope, I think, is that they'll be able to sort of reach a consensus with the union. So, for instance, on rail, Labour's policy, which has been briefed in advance, is that they will allow a state-owned company to compete with private firms for rail franchises as they come up for renewal. But there are some of the trade unions, some on the left, who would like Labour to say we will automatically return these franchises to
the... 66% of voters, I think.
Yes, so, I mean, and this obviously bolsters their case that you say you want to be in the centre ground. You know, the centre ground is where voters are on the left. So that will be difficult for Miliband. But more broadly, the big message he wants to get out is that Labour is now about big reforms, not big spending. That's an acknowledgement that the party has work to do in improving its economic credibility, and it's also about wanting to show the ambition and vision that someone like John Cruddas has called for, and so he'll hope to get that message out in the speech he's making on Saturday, and then has quite a busy week ahead. He'll be flying to Washington on Monday, hoping for a brief meeting with Barack Obama, and that coincides with the speech Tony Blair is making to mark the 20th anniversary of his election as party leader.
Which I suspect that Ed Miliband will be very glad to be out of the country for, and therefore not able to comment on. Well, it looks like at least a final fling of at least one more exciting week before recess, so we'll catch you up on all those developments next week. Thank you, Lucy and George. Joined by Ian Stebbin and Juliet Jakes to talk about football. Football! Come on, I feel our excitement building in the room already. I, as you know, I'm sure our regular podcast listeners will know, I'm a huge expert on football and everything related to it. Juliet, you support Norwich, so yes. Let's say you know nothing about football. No, tell me whether or not you think that... was this the best World Cup ever?
Not the best World Cup ever. I think it was quite enjoyable. The group stages were really great. There were lots of... really intriguing encounters between established powers and not so established teams. There were very few teams who looked like they were there just to make up the numbers, which is kind of surprising given how kind of bloated the tournament feels with 32 sides in it. I thought the group, the second round games were enjoyable on the whole. The problem, once you got to the quarterfinals I thought were really flat, a really poor selection of games. And all the interesting teams went out at that stage. You had this really kind of exciting young French team that had kind of kicked out most of the people who'd kind of brought shame on the country 4 years ago. They couldn't really find a way through Germany and they went out. Costa Rica was so much more fun than Holland and they lost on penalties and Tim Krul just, you know, didn't behave very well. You know, that charmless, cynical Brazil team beat Colombia.
And Chile.
And Chile,
both,
yeah.
Two teams that were both fantastic.
And then sort of Argentina just kind of...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Edged their way round a sort of, you know, Belgium team that a lot was expected of, who kind of did the bare minimum to get to the quarterfinals, which was a creditable performance, but, you know... didn't play particularly well. I mean, what really rescued the tournament was Germany's hammering of Brazil in the semi-final.
I think that might be my favourite football match I've ever seen, for the fact that I've never before felt the emotion of, like, the horror of a team that's ahead scoring another goal. I'm thinking, don't score another goal.
I support Norwich, happens every week.
I'm a Wolves fan, it happens to us too. Yeah.
What's the most that you've ever seen Norwich lose by?
Well, famously, we lost 7-1 to Colchester United on the opening day of the third division season, I think 5 years ago. And we're at home and we play in yellow. So much like Brazil, really. And Norwich responded by stealing the Colchester manager, winning the division, and then getting promoted again to the Premier League the following season. So, you know, who knows what could happen to Brazil. All they need to do is steal the German manager.
I think
maybe
still
a load
Colchester
of their
manager.
Well, Aston Villa, he's out now. They'll let you have him, I think. So, yeah.
They'll pay you to take him off his hands, I think, at the moment.
And Wolves, what is the most number of goals you've seen Wolves lose by?
I was at Fulham. We lost 5-0. It was the season we got relegated from the Premier League 2 seasons ago. It was a very... Fulham has this lovely, quaint, grounds, Craven Cottage, where it's by the river, so the wind whips in really fast and cold. Even this was a March, like a cold March day, and I was standing there with my dad, and we were just getting more and more depressed.
This is kind of turning into a therapy session.
Yeah, I felt especially bad because he wanted to leave after the third goal went in. He was like, "This is the point." It's like, no, we're staying, we're sticking to the end.
On the therapy theme, I've seen Norwich lose 6-0 at Fulham and get relegated in a must-win game. But the last time I was there. Earlier this season for an FA Cup replay, and we went 1-0 down after 10 minutes. And I just put my head in my hands, and this has happened to me in every walk of life except football but by that point. But the steward just came up to me, put her hand on my shoulder and just said, "Are you all right?" Never had that before. And you felt like doing that to a lot of the Brazilian sort of fans and players in the semi-final. The best moment really was seeing Luis Felipe Scolari, who's a a really kind of win-at-all-costs manager. He's put together some horrible teams in the past, and this was one of his worst. And you just saw him when Germany went 2-0 up, sort of turn around to his assistant and just say, oh, this isn't going right well, what should we do? And by the time they sort of finished the conversation, they're 5-0 down.
That was the most astonishing thing about that game, was that the fact that the goals all came within... I mean, literally, there must have been people who went out for a cup of tea and went, what? Mm. Hang on a minute, what?
I was in a Brazilian bar in Pimlico, and you know the Brazilian anthem ends kind of a cappella. It was incredible. It's this kind of moment where you've got the players and the fans in the stadium, and I'm sure people watching in bars and... things all over the world singing along with the anthem. It's a really powerful moment. And I thought, well, I don't like this Brazil team. But having just witnessed that moment, I kind of would like to see them win now. But then you kind of watch them playing. You're like, no, you're awful. Go home.
Taking a harsh line there. What have we learned about football? That's a big question, Ian, from the World Cup.
Well, something I find quite interesting is this idea, the entire debate over whether it's the best World Cup ever. Because me being the young age I am, the earliest World Cup I remember is 94 in the US, and even barely the one I remember properly is 98. And I do wonder how many people saying this is the best or worst or whatever World Cup ever have actually seen everyone that was televised, really. It does seem, I think it was fantastically amazing value and the best international tournament of any kind, including Euros or Confederation Cups or what have you, since... probably, I don't know.
2000, I think.
Yeah, Euro 2000. Yeah.
I got very excited about Germany. We had to do some sorting up for the Sunday politics about football. So there was me in an intensive Wikipedia session the night before. But we had a great piece last year by a writer, a football writer, about the idea about what we can learn from the way that Germany has structured its club system. Mm. Which I thought was really fascinating. So there are two things. There's this fan ownership model, a 50+1 system, so that fans always have the controlling vote. You can't be kind of bought out by somebody and just turned into a cash machine. And also the fact that they put a huge amount into youth training. I mean, Juliet, can you ever see England adopting a similar system?
It's hard to see widespread fan ownership in England. I think there's only one fan-owned team in the Football League at the moment, which is Portsmouth, who went through a number of kind of bizarre and kind of terrifying changes of ownership. David Conn wrote a really good piece about it with The Guardian a couple of years ago, which I didn't understand. One of these owners may not even have existed. There's only kind of one known photo of him, a guy called Ali Al-Faraj. Very little is known about him, apart from that he wears a baseball cap. He's a bit like William Hague. And
I think he definitely existed.
I think.
He didn't hallucinate him for the last
time. I've heard that voice. And... So Portsmouth, kind of after just kind of years of bankruptcy, more than one spell of administration, very quick drop from the top division to the bottom one, are now fan-owned. Otherwise, you look through substantive portions of the Premier League and the Championship, which is division below. A lot of clubs are just owned by kind of European or Middle Eastern oligarchs now. The takeover at Leeds United recently, Massimo Cellino, is very interesting. He had a kind of legal situation. I can't remember exactly what, so I'll be careful what I say about that. But there was some debate as to whether or not he'd be allowed to take over Leeds United. In the end, he was. The fit and proper person test for owning football clubs in this country is notoriously lax. Famously, Manchester City being taken over by Thaksin Shinawatra, the former Thai Prime Minister, who was wanted for kind of numerous human rights offences at the time. Yeah,
and money laundering.
Quite happy to turn up at Manchester City and own them. So I can't see fan ownership for a while. I mean, there's a lot of hand-wringing, isn't there, about the way that youngsters are trained in this country.
We had a fantastic piece by Gary Lineker in the Russell Brand Gazette, yes, in which he said two things. First of all, the pushy parents are ruining, because they sort of shout, like, take out his legs! at this sort of seven-year-old who's running up and down. And the fact that they force them to play on full-size pitches, so everybody just learns how to hoof it really far. And actually, we never get the kind of messy style people who are just much nippier. Look at me, I'm talking about football. This is you must be
very, very cogently.
Is there anything else you think that England could do or might do? And after our slightly ignominious exit,
I do find it funny that 4 years ago everyone was saying we must copy the Spanish model, and now everyone's saying we must copy the German model. But funnily enough, I mean, those two countries do have kind of a similar base, which is that they just have an order of magnitude more coaches per young player than the English system does. And they don't have those kind of prejudices against small players that the English system has. And actually, that's something that did come out of the World Cup as well. Is this German team is really impressive, but I don't think it's anything like the Spanish team that was at its peak 4 years ago. And I mean, some people find that tiki-taka kind of boring.
Me included.
Yeah. So I enjoyed it, that kind of thing. I know there's a bit of that, but it was very much a dominant philosophy that you knew everyone on that player knew exactly what they were doing. Whereas the German team that just won the World Cup did it more, almost playing like a Premier League team. Very fast, a lot of wide play, a lot of rapid counter-attacking. And that system doesn't really rely upon intimate knowledge of one particular style. It just relies on just good coaching from a young age and an ability to be flexible. So maybe saying, copying the German system is more realistic, because it just means making the England team play like Manchester United.
I mean, also the sort of Spanish tiki-taka model. I mean, yeah, 4 years ago, Spain, closest to being unbeatable as any international team I've seen. I mean, they actually did lose one game in that tournament.
Yeah. They went on something like a 30-game winning streak
as
well.
Yeah, it was an astonishing length of time unbeaten. But the big tactical change I think we saw in this World Cup is to sort of counter the tiki-taka model is players who can break quickly from midfield, like France had Pogba, Germany had Müller, Holland had Robben. And a lot of the better sides had somebody who could do that. And that's the way to play through a team that just kind of keeps possession is find somebody who can win the ball and very quickly quickly hit them on the break. So I think we're seeing more of that kind of football, which I think is more suited to England. But there are like a worrying dearth of young players. I mean, I can't think of any kind of young English players coming through at the moment for whom I have genuinely high hopes. I guess Raheem Sterling's
the obvious one, because he's still only 18, I think.
I think so, yeah.
But we really don't. I mean, Joe Hart's going to be in goal for like another decade probably, because that's how goalkeepers work. Yeah. But the defence is at the moment and for the future looks mediocre.
Oh,
the midfield at the moment looks mediocre and is going to stay mediocre. The attack, maybe there's some good
Sturridge, Rooney and Sterling's not a bad front three, I don't think.
But there's just, it does look like, there was the golden generation of Gerrard and Lampard and whatever that never played together well, really, and never really achieved all
very
the
glad they're going.
Yeah, but I'm glad, I didn't want Gerrard or Lampard to be going to Brazil, frankly.
Well, they wouldn't be if there were better younger players coming through, I don't
entirely
think.
Point,
I mean,
yeah.
I don't blame Hodgson for picking them or them for going.
Yeah.
But on that really depressing note, that all our players who are retiring are rubbish and all the people who are coming through are rubbish
even
as well.
Worse.
I'll say thank you very much to Ian and Julia. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast. You can find us every week on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast. Our theme tune is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons, and our producer is Philip Maughan.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.